It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
I just left Walter Reed Medical Center, and it's really something very special. The doctors, the nurses, the first responders, and I learned so much about coronavirus. And one thing that's for certain, don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it. You're going to beat it. We have the best medical equipment. We have the best medicines, all developed recently. And you're going to beat it. I didn't feel so good. And 2 days ago, I could have left 2 days ago. 2 days ago, I felt great, like better than I have in a long time. I said just recently, better than 20 years ago. Don't let it dominate. Don't let it take over your lives. Don't let that happen. We have the greatest country in the world. We're going back. We're going back to work. We're going to be out front. As your leader, I had to do that. I knew there's danger to it, but I had to do it. I stood out front. I led. Nobody that's a leader would not do what I did. And I know there's a risk, there's a danger, but that's okay. And now I'm better, and maybe I'm immune, I don't know. But don't let it dominate your lives. Get out there, be careful. We have the best medicines in the world, and it all happened very shortly, and they're all getting approved, and the vaccines are coming momentarily. Thank you very much, and Walter Reed, what a group of people. Thank you very much.
All right, so that was President Donald Trump when he went back home to the White House last night, and that's what he had to say. He said to us, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of COVID, and I'm going to come back to that in just a second. But for the moment, I want to talk about, you know, his journey from the Walter Reed Hospital to the White House, because reporters are there covering it. You know they're there because they're so concerned that the president, they're president is sick, right? They're just so concerned. And when he was released, they were just so happy, right? Just so happy. Well, maybe not so much. In fact, just yesterday, earlier in the day before he was released, there was an accidental catch of a reporter off to the side commenting on the fact, after the doctors had come out and said the president was doing well, they were going to release him. This is what the reporter said. It's clip 7. Let's listen.
That wasn't as fun as yesterday.
That wasn't as fun as yesterday. Yesterday it was really bad news. He was not doing well. That wasn't as fun as yesterday. That was one of the reporters outside. And of course, then when the president was released and he walked back and was waving at them at a distance, of course, at a distance, this is the kinds of questions they ask him. I just found this stunning. And this is clip 8.
Mr. President, how many staff are sick? How many of your staff are sick?
Thank you very much.
Do you think you might be a super spreader, Mr. President?
All right, so let's see. The President of the United States has just been released from the hospital to go back to the White House. And from all appearances, he's been he's recovering. He is maybe not totally out of the woods, but he's recovering. We have dodged a bullet here as a nation. And you might think you'd say, good to see you, Mr. President. We're grateful you're up on your feet and going back home. We are. How are you feeling, Mr. President? What's, you know, maybe something like that. But what did we get? We got, how many of your staffers have tested positive? How many? How many have tested positive? And then you get, you think you might be a super spreader? The questions from the press. So yeah, that's if this does not help America recognize how out of their minds the American press is, I'm not sure what will. And so to drive it home even further, after the president said Don't be afraid of COVID. Don't let it dominate your life. We've developed great medicines. And you can, you know, he's inferring they're available to you, and they will be. They are. Some of them already are, and the others will be. Don't let it dominate your life. Don't be afraid. But the media responded in a very unique way. I'd like for you to hear it. It's clip 5.
President Trump wrote on Twitter, "Don't be afraid of COVID. Don't let it dominate your life." Almost 210,000 Americans are dead.
Speaking of outrageous, this outrageous tweet.
Oh my goodness, Nicole. When I saw that, Trump, I mean, I literally was overwhelmed.
And now we see this tweet, which is heartless. It is cruel.
Jake, this is so disrespectful. I'm not even sure I can speak about this. It's incredibly incredibly disrespectful. What does that mean? Don't be afraid of it. I mean, first of all, it's a contagious disease that kills people. There's nowhere to even begin. It's gross.
It's such a distressing moment.
It's just so horrible, so destructive to say I feel better than I have in 20 years.
That he's saying this is so disrespectful.
The president says it's no big deal. I mean, it's outrageous.
It is insulting to the people who have lost loved ones. It is insulting to every American who wears a mask. I mean, it's disgraceful, Wolf. It's absurd.
Don't tell your supporters, don't be afraid of COVID. Everyone should be afraid of COVID.
It's okay to be afraid of COVID, and it's okay that it's dominating your life because it has dominated your life.
Well, I'm sure that makes sense in some world, Jake. You should let it dominate your life because it has been dominating your life. Okay, so let's talk about it for a second. 210 Americans dead, that's not an accurate stat, according to the CDC. According to the CDC, only 6% of the people they've listed of dying from COVID have died from COVID. 94% of them died from other things with COVID. They happened to contract COVID before they had their motorcycle accident. That's actually happened. That the CDC has admitted that. It's heartless. It was disrespectful. What does that mean? It's so horrible. It's destructive to say it's no big deal. It's absurd. The thing that's absurd is the panicked thought that the media might not be able to scare you to death for the next however many months they want to control you. And that the truth is that even at Donald Trump's age and his overweightedness that they love to call obesity, he still has a 95% chance of surviving. 95%! And for the rest of you listening to me, you have a 99% chance of surviving should you contract COVID. You might have a cold, you might sneeze, you might not feel well. I actually think I had it back in January when I came back from CPAC. I didn't feel well, but I'm alive. I'm not afraid. Don't be afraid. That's what he's saying. Stop being so afraid. You know, we're all going to die at some point. Anyway, Alex Berenson was the New York Times, former New York Times reporter that I am fond of, very fond of. Alex was on with, I think, with Tucker last night. And this is what he had to say about the president's admonition to not be afraid of COVID. Here's Alex.
I want to say something about what the president said today, what he tweeted today, where he said, don't be afraid of COVID. Don't let it dominate your life. That might be the most presidential thing this president has ever said. OK, because here's what he's saying. He's not actually saying don't be afraid of COVID. He's saying don't be afraid of one another. OK, because this is a respiratory virus. It spreads between people. And the only way to really make it go away permanently is to lock us all away permanently. And that can't happen. That is not compatible with life. And something that I will never forget is walking around Times Square about six months ago, and walking around New York City, and it was deserted. It was as if a neutron bomb had gone off, and yeah. Everyone was terrified. Nobody was going outside. And look, 6 months ago, even then, that response really didn't make sense, but there were reasons for it. Okay, but we are 6 months on, and we know that if you believe the WHO and 750 million people have been infected with this, that the death rate is about 1 in 1,000, meaning 999 out of 1,000 people will live after getting the coronavirus. If you believe the CDC numbers, it might be 997, maybe it's 996 out of 1,000. It is a tiny death rate. And we have gone crazy, and we have sacrificed our kids, and we have sacrificed society. And Donald Trump walked out of that hospital today and said what needed to be said. We have to stop being so afraid of this. We put people on the moon. We're the first, manned flight in 1903. What has happened to us that this rather dismal virus has scared everyone to death? I do not understand it, and we have to get out of this.
All right, good. Preach it, Alex. That's all I can say. Tonight we have another debate. It's between the Vice President and Kamala Harris. It's happening tonight in Utah at Salt Lake City at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Tomorrow night. Sorry. I'm glad you corrected me. Thank you very much. Tomorrow night. Okay, so I'll talk more about that later. But I want to go back to the last debate. In the last debate, you will remember there was this famous moment with Chris Wallace and Joe Biden carping at the president. That's my word for it. It annoyed me very much. I played it earlier. I want to revisit it. Let's listen to clip 14.
You have repeatedly criticized the vice president for not specifically calling out Antifa and other left-wing extremist groups. But are you willing tonight to condemn white supremacists and militia groups and to say that they need to stand down and not add to the violence in a number of these cities, as we saw in Kenosha and as we've seen in Portland?
Sure,
are you
I'm
prepared
to
specifically
that,
do it?
Well, I would say almost everything I see is from the left wing, not from the right wing.
So what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it.
Do you want to call him? What do you want to call him? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
right wing. Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right wing.
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem. This is a
left-wing.
This is a left-wing problem.
White supremacist. Antifa's an idea, not an organization.
Oh, you got it.
Not malicious. That's what FBI director said.
Well, then you know what?
We're done, sir. We're moving on to the next. We're moving
on to the next administration. That's not an idea.
Everybody in your administration tells you the truth has a bad idea.
Can I tell you what?
You have no ideas.
Antifa is a dangerous radical group.
All right, gentlemen, we're now moving on to the Trump and Biden records.
What a difference a week makes. Okay, so they cut him off. And after, Chris actually set up the president on that, I have to tell you. Because Chris knew that the president of the United States has disavowed white supremacism for years. It started back in 2000. And because I know that's true, we have found this clip. And the first statement the president makes, he wasn't president in 2000. You'll hear that first and just listen to him over and over again denouncing white supremacism. Clip 3.
Got David Duke just joined, a bigot, a racist, a problem. I mean, this is not exactly the people you want in your party.
Yeah, David Duke and all were disavowed. I disavowed him on Friday. I disavowed him right after that because I thought if there was any question.
I didn't even know he endorsed me. David Duke endorsed me? Okay. All right. I disavow, okay?
I disavowed David Duke, and I disavowed him the day before at a major news conference. David Duke is a bad person who I disavowed on numerous occasions over the years. I'm saying to myself, how many times do I have to continue to disavow people?
So are you prepared right now to make a clear and unequivocal statement renouncing the support of all white supremacists?
Of course I am. Of course I am. I mean, there's nobody that's done so much for equality as I have.
Racism is evil. And those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists.
This is about David Duke all weekend long on Facebook, on Twitter. And obviously, it's never enough. I disavow him every time I speak to somebody virtually. And, they just keep it going. They keep it going. And
I totally disavow the Ku Klux Klan. I totally disavow David Duke. I've been doing it now for 2 weeks. This is you're probably about the 18th person that's asked me the question.
All right. That's just a portion of it. That was President Trump. And yet, the takeaway from that debate last week was that he would not disavow white supremacism. Chris Wallace knew he had done that. He is too clued in to have missed that. And yet, he set it up in such a way that it made the president look like he was trying to avoid it. It's just really despicable from my point of view. Really, some very interesting news coming up next with Phil Kirpin on the treatment of COVID. Stay tuned.
Well, these are certainly tough, tough times, aren't they? Hi, it's Michael Woolworth with Bible League International, engaging the world with God's Word for more than 80 years at only $5 a Bible. You know, I'm grateful that God has given Bible League a platform for more than 8 decades to address the other pandemic, and that's the shortage of Bibles all over the world in places like Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. In fact, at Bible League, we determine that as few as 1 Christian in 10 has a Bible. What's that mean? That during this pandemic, many evangelical Christians elsewhere in the world cannot open their Bible and be reminded of God's promises, like 1 Peter 5:7, cast your cares on Him, for He cares for you. But you know, during this time of sheltering in place, we can shelter in grace. Learn how you can be a blessing to believers around the world praying for a Bible by visiting sendbiblesnow.org. That's sendbiblesnow.org, or by calling Bible League at 800-YES-WORD, 800-YES-WORD.
This is Pause to Pray, a chance each day to stop down from the daily noise of life and pray for our country's leaders.
Today, we pray for Larry Turner, Deputy Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Labor. He oversees audit and investigation programs and combats the influence of organized crime and corruption in the workplace. Proverbs 10:9 reminds us of the importance of integrity. Whoever walks in integrity walks securely, but whoever takes crooked paths will be found out. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Almighty God, we ask for guidance for Larry Turner at the Department of Labor. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of this station and the Presidential Prayer Team. Get your copy of Pray the Vote, featuring helpful ways to pray during election season. More than 25,000 people have already received their copies. It's free and available now at pausetopray.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
My goal as a teacher is to impart knowledge and then be able then for them to take it and turn it into wisdom. As we teach, I think, okay, 5 years down the road, how will the material that I am teaching them really affect their lives and their careers?
Hi, Todd Starnes here. Truett offers biblically-centered degree programs. Check out truett.edu/starnes. Every day, Brendan Stanton, a middle school teacher in Tacoma, Washington, asks students a question: who do they admire and why? Elsie Kusander's 10-year-old son told the class he admired President Trump, said the president's making America great again, and that he built the wall to keep the terrorists out of the country. Instead of thanking the boy for his submission, the teacher became enraged and scolded the child, kicking the student out of the virtual classroom. The teacher then told the class President Trump had created division and hate, refusing to even mention the president's name, told the children they should not admire such a person. You know, it seems to me the only person creating hate and division is Brendan Stanton. And honestly, it's time to start removing these left-wing propagandists from classrooms funded by the American taxpayers. Be sure to listen to my national radio show live noon to 3 Eastern or download my free podcast at toddstarnes.com.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
The religious community has to agree to the rules, and they have to agree that they are going to follow the rules, and they have to agree that they are going to be a full partner in the enforcement of the rules. That's condition one. I'm going to meet with members of the ultra-Orthodox community tomorrow. I want to have that conversation directly myself. This cannot happen again. If you do not agree to enforce the rules, then we'll close the institutions down. I am prepared to do that.
That creepy kind of message was actually pretty long. That was the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, yesterday, threatening churches. He went in the synagogues. He went into great length, actually. We just pulled a part of that to tell them what they couldn't do. And he used two photos to demonstrate how out of control the Orthodox Jewish community is. Look at how they're meeting in groups, and they're way over the number, and how dare they? But the problem was the photo that he used was 14 years old. 14 years old, and he claimed in that interaction that it was a recent photo. I mean, it's really despicable. He also then added to that he was closing effective today. This is an announcement last night. Schools that are in affected areas. And, you know, just wielding power left and right with disregard. That's my analysis. I've asked Phil Kirpin to join us this morning. He's the president and founder of American Commitment. And Phil, in the last, I've said this to you before because Phil's been with us several times. Phil is a very highly respected, I don't know what to call Phil. You're highly respected, whatever it is you're looking at and researching. I know you to be an honest and trustworthy guy, and I really appreciate your research and your reporting. And recently, in the last 6-7 months, you have really been concentrating on COVID, and that's what we're going to talk about this morning. So first of all, good morning, and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Sandy. Great to be with you.
You know, I've heard, even in a Fox report probably a week or 10 days ago, I heard absolutely conflicting reports in the same report. One said that COVID is, the rate of infection is going down, and in the very same report, it said the rate of infection is going up. And Cuomo, I guess, issued those draconian statements because the spread is supposedly getting worse in New York. What is the truth here? Honestly, what is the state of the infection rate and hospitalizations and all of that? Can you tell us?
Nationally, it's definitely going down. It has been going down for quite a while. We had a big peak, the biggest peak, of course, in April, and then we had a lower peak in July as it went through the southern states. But we've been in a continuous national decline in prevalence since that July peak. And if you look at, for instance, the percentage of tests that are coming back positive, it's been under 5% for the last couple of weeks. Yesterday, I think nationally, it was 4.1 or so. The average over the last week is about 4.7. That's been on the decline. Reported deaths have been on a decline. Hospitalizations are a little bit trickier in terms of the national numbers. They're kind of stalled out, but that's in large part because of the way they're counting them and the fact that everyone who comes into a hospital now gets tested and they count them as a COVID hospitalization until the test comes back negative, by which time they've got all the people who checked in the next day and the same thing repeats itself. And so there's sort of an artificial floor under hospitalizations. There are two regions of the country right now where the CDC is seeing a slight increase in the emergency room visits with COVID-like symptoms, and that's usually been the best leading indicator of where it's going. Those are regions 5 and 8, which are the Midwest and the Mountain States. Some of those areas have not had much before. And one of the things I've concluded watching this happen through the country is pretty much every place is going to have its epidemic. It's going to come, it's going to rise, it's going to fall. You can't really avoid it almost no matter what you do. You can try to lock everything down, but at some point it's going to come no matter what you do. And most of the country has been through it. And so I don't see another big national increase for that reason. But there are some places, it's a very big country, there are some places that haven't. And so that's why you see on the news, for instance, that hospitalizations have been rising in Wisconsin, which hadn't really seen it prior to right now. And Montana is in a little bit of a second hump in parts of the state that didn't see it in the first hump, and Idaho the same thing. But really, all of the big states have been through it. And so I don't think we're going to see the national numbers go back up again for that reason. We may see the so-called case numbers go up, which we saw in Europe, without any significant increase in hospitalizations, ICUs, or deaths. That has to do with the way the tests work and that they overstate their disease burden. They show a lot of sort of trivial positives, but I don't think we're likely to see another major increase in disease burden in the places that already had it. New York, I believe, in the areas where they are seeing slight increases in the test positives, I think they're seeing what happened in Europe, essentially, which is sort of an echo false epidemic after the major epidemic where you get testing results, but they're not followed by disease burden. I certainly hope it's that and not some kind of true second wave. It is interesting that the communities that appear to be, testing positive again after having already had it are, you know, religious communities that are very communal and very closely connected, a lot of close contact. And, I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's how, you know, the Orthodox Jewish community is. But, you know, it might mean that they're going to end up with sort of a level of disease burden that's higher than most other places that have less social interaction. That said, they had a lot of disease burden the first time around, so I'm skeptical that they have a lot of susceptible people left. And I think that the way that Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo keep singling out the Jewish community in particular for restrictions, and they keep announcing them on Jewish holidays so that the affected wow. community is the last people to find out, it looks really bad. And I think they appear to harbor some kind of animus.
Boy, I believe that too, Phil. I think it's becoming more and more obvious. I just thought Cuomo's whole attitude, I when I watched him, you know, a few months ago, he seemed persuasive almost. Almost I was persuaded to believe that Andrew Cuomo really cared. But I think now it's taken on kind of a cynicism and a control. It's becoming harder to hide, I guess it's what I would say. But the interesting thing to me, too, is that where they're reporting these upticks, I was just kind of catching a few things here and there. New York, Wisconsin, and I think Michigan claimed also to have an uptick. Yes, I heard the governor talk about that, their governor. These are places that are you know, doing the masking. They're the ones that are doing the social distancing. Those are the places that are the strictest, and yet they're reporting upticks. And then they turn around and blame it on, I don't know what they're blaming it on. It makes no sense. It seems to contradict their very premise that if you wear masks all the time and social distance, we will stop the virus. And I just don't see that happening.
Well, I think there's a seasonal factor also. And it's interesting to me that, you know, it started in the spring in these northern states, and then it sort of moved south into the summer. And, you know, now we're heading into the fall, and it appears to be starting in the very far north again. And at the same time we're seeing, you know, Wisconsin and Minnesota pick up activity, we're also seeing the same latitudes in Canada. And it doesn't seem to have any great relationship to any policies. We're seeing the same thing at similar latitudes in Europe, by the way. And so I think there are seasonal factors here in play, and we're moving into, you know, the fall, we're moving into respiratory illness season again for this next season. You know, you're going to start to see the effects of that. The other issue is that even if you don't have higher COVID burden, you're going to start getting more positive tests because other coronaviruses can cross-react on the tests. And so if you've got a lot of common cold coronaviruses in an area, you're going to get more false positives as a function of that, and then you may get more policy reaction and panic that isn't even based on actual COVID. And, you know, we've done basically no validation of the tests in the U.S., but there was a very detailed validation study that was done in Germany a few months ago, and they found that one of the common cold coronaviruses, HCoV-229E, generates a positive on the COVID test about 7.5% of the time. So it's not a huge amount, but if that's circulating a lot in a community, you know, you're going to start getting more positives. And so there are a lot of factors here. To me, what I like to watch are the emergency room visits. I think they're much more meaningful than the tests, and they give you a better sense of where things are going. And we're still nationally in the emergency room visits with COVID symptoms. We're still nationally basically the same place we were in both the June low and in the off-season last year. And the big question is whether in the new season that starts to move up again. And as I said, there are 10 regions that HHS has for the country. Two of them showed a slight increase in the most recent report. And so it is possible that we'll see, you know, something of a second wave or, you know, a first in areas that never really had it. But the important point is what you said. This has nothing to do with policy. We should not try to make it some moral failing if somebody catches essentially a nasty cold. That is not a moral failing. That's just the reality of living in the world. And you know, I really liked what the president said. You know, take sensible precautions, but don't let this dominate your life. Don't let fear of this prevent you from doing anything else. We need to, you know, be able to live and with this virus existing. And frankly, the vast, vast majority of people are at very, very low risk with this. So we need to be much more realistic and panic less. And frankly, Sandy, the places that had the worst outcomes were the places with the most draconian policies. New York and New Jersey have the highest death rates in the entire world. The lockdowns did nothing to help, but they hurt because they caused panic and fear. and people who felt this, you know, anxiety, which caused them to feel a little shortness of breath, went to the hospital and freaked out. A lot of them ended up being put on ventilators that killed them. Panic and fear are not conducive to getting good health outcomes. They produce the opposite. And so, you know, I don't think anyone knows for sure exactly where this is headed, but we have so much more knowledge now and so much better treatments and procedures that, you know, for most people, you're probably going to be fine if you get this. You know, under age 20, it's 99.997% survival, according to the CDC. 20 to 49, it's 99.98% survival. 50 to 70, it's 99.5. And above 70 is where there's a risk. It's about a 5% risk of death above age 70, although it's much, much higher for long-term care population than it is for independent living seniors. And so even within that group, there's a big differential of risk. And, you know, we even for the highest risk categories, you know, someone like President Trump, who's over age 70, who's a little bit overweight, who fits, you know, the sort of the profile of the highest risk, most of them are fine. They handle it fine, overwhelmingly, statistically. And so I think we need to put it in perspective. We can't continue to let it totally dominate our lives. We should be smart to the extent we can. You don't need to have huge events and lots of people packed in close together, especially poorly ventilated spaces seem to be a problem. So if you've got an HVAC system in a commercial space or what have you, make sure the fresh air intakes are open. If you have windows that open and the temperature outside is amenable to it, opening windows is great. But let's not have any more time like these 6 months that were lost for so many of us to sort of fear an irrational policy response that didn't actually seem to have any benefit attached to it.
Did you, Phil, did you catch the media response to the president's statement? I played a montage just a few, before you joined me. They're going apoplectic over that statement. It's ridiculous. It's stupid. How dare he? How cruel? How? Because the president said, "Don't let COVID run your life, and stop being afraid."
I mean, love this statement. But look, they want us afraid. I mean, they've been hyping the fear of this as a, you know, I mean, from the way the media has been talking about this, would you think that children up to age 20 have a 99.997% survival rate?
No, and I mean, and that's the reason schools are closed. And teachers are, of course, teachers
crazy.
Have another reason.
It's an insane thing. And by the way, we've got a few studies now, including a very, very big study from Scotland with 300,000 people in it, that finds that exposure to young children is protective for adults because they get exposed to colds and various other immune system challenges that make their own immune system stronger. And then if they do get exposed to the coronavirus, they're much less likely to get sick because they have a stronger immune system. And so the closures have not just been damaging for children and their education in the future, they've actually denied a health benefit with respect to coronavirus to the teachers who aren't getting that exposure.
It's insanity, and it has been for months, and that's why I know that you have been working with Alex Behrens, and I'm so grateful the two of you are on the front lines with this. I try to bring truth every single day because this just drives me crazy. As I see people in church, people in grocery stores. I don't know if you saw this. This is in Northern Virginia. It was a couple of months ago, probably 3 or 4 months ago. A woman, you know, all masked up, and she has like a yardstick in front of her, and she's waving the yardstick as she pushes her cart to make sure that no one comes closer to her than 6 feet. We have become a nation. I rode in a plane, Phil, next to a 26-year-old young man who was dressed in a hazmat suit, and he had like a World War I mask on with that hose. He had his hands covered. He was frightened out of his mind, a young, healthy guy. This is to where we have descended, and that's why the president's admonition to stop worrying and not let it dominate your life was the presidential thing to say. Someone has to bring sanity back to this country. Phil Kirpin is my guest. He's with American Commitment. He's the president and founder. And when we return, Phil has written about a new form of testing, which I find fascinating. And it also goes to how the FDA and the CDC are handling what's happening to us, their failures. It's time to look at that. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk. We'll be right back.
American Family Radio newscasts are now available as a podcast.
I'm Rusty Pugh.
I'm Steve Jordahl.
Didn't catch the full story? Listen to the podcast.
I'm Chris Woodward.
I'm Chad Groening.
Didn't have the radio on at the top of the hour? Listen to the podcast.
I'm Charlie Bunch.
And I'm Fred Jackson.
Get accurate news from a Christian perspective whenever you want it with the American Family News podcast. You can also sign up for our daily news brief. Visit onenewsnow.com. AFR programming is now available on Alexa.
You're joking, right?
Nope, not joking.
Seriously?
Yep, this is not a drill.
Wait a minute. No way.
There's a way. The Alexa way. So if you just happen to miss your favorite shows, no worries. You can now listen to each podcast with Alexa. It's simple and it's free. Just visit afr.net/apps and click Alexa. We're not joking.
For nothing is secret that will not be revealed. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe has now informed congressional officials that before the deep state coup attempt against President Trump began via its Russian collusion investigation, intelligence agencies learned that Russia knew of Hillary Clinton's plan to tarnish Trump with the collusion smear. At one point, former CIA Director John Brennan personally briefed then-President Barack Obama and other top U.S. national security officials that Russia assessed that Hillary Clinton had approved the plan on July 26, 2016 to, quote, vilify Donald Trump by stirring up a scandal claiming interference by Russian security services, end quote. This all according to John Brennan's handwritten notes.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Brian Fisher here with the Life and Liberty Minute. As the people of God, we are headed into a great war, and we even know the exact date on which it will happen. There is an enormous conflict in the heavenly places between the forces of God and the forces of evil over what kind of nation we will be. We will meet on a great battlefield on November 3 to decide whether we will be a nation that honors God, honors the Word of God, cherishes religious liberty, protects the lives of the unborn, believes in the institution of God-ordained marriage, believes in normative sexuality, and believes in the rule of law. This is not a battle that anyone can afford to sit out. The character and future of our country is at stake, and if it seems we are outnumbered, let us never forget the words of Scripture, those who are with us are more than those who are with them.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Trump has returned to the White House for the remainder of what will hopefully continue to be an extraordinarily speedy recovery from the Chinese Communist Party virus. Before he left the hospital, Mr. Trump made a Churchillian appeal to our countrymen and women. He urged them not to, quote, let COVID-19 dominate you, unquote. That could mark a tipping point, since for months, the pandemic has been exploited for that very purpose, serving as a political control mechanism over the American people, our economy, and our freedoms. If the president continues to heal and lead, he will upend the transparent agenda of our nation's adversaries, foreign and domestic, to employ the CCP virus as a weapon that keeps us afraid and isolated, demoralized and unfree. Should that happen, it will be Donald Trump's finest hour, and one that just may save our republic. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
All right, just something practical. Thursday night, American Family Association is sponsoring a town hall. It's going to be online. It's AFA at Home. And you have to register. You go to afaaction.net, afaaction.net. You can register and join us. Now, who's going to be there? It's going to be Dr. Richard Land, the Benham Brothers, David and Jason, Star Parker, Abraham Hamilton III, and yours truly, Sandy Rios. Also, Tim Barton of Wall Builders. So I think that you might want to join us. It starts at 7 o'clock Central Standard Time, and it's Thursday night, October the 8th, and you go to afaaction.net and register. Well, it's certainly true that COVID has changed our lives this last several months. It's been one of the most frustrating experiences for me, because I just can't stand lies. And I feel like it's been constant lies, just constant lies that have changed our lives. And I see my friends in fear. I see family fearing. And it is maddening when it's the constant reporting is just false. Fox is one of the worst. I mean, they repeat Jake's on ABC, but they repeat constantly this 210,000 people have died, when we know that the CDC, what, 6 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, told us that that was really not accurate. Only 6% of that 200 and whatever it was at the time, 200,000, had actually died of COVID. The other 94% had died of something, and they had COVID. And so it's just a complete deception, and it's pretty much, at least they have come close to wrecking the American economy, and certainly it's going to have some effect on this presidential election. Phil Kirpin is my guest. He's the president and founder of American Commitment. Phil, speaking of the CDC and their guidelines and the Health National Institutes for Health, the names, like the brands that we've trusted for years, you have just written an article about the testing protocol and the test that we've been using, and you say they are all wrong, and that the powers that be, the FDA, have prevented the really good tests from being produced. Can you explain that, please?
Yeah, absolutely, Sandy. We are now running up to 1 million PCR tests per day. These are the polymerase chain reaction lab tests, where they stick the swab all the way up your nose into the back of your throat, and then send it off to a lab, and the collection costs about $100, and the lab running the test costs about $100, and we're spending about $1 billion, more than $1 billion now, a week on these tests. And we've got this massive sort of testing industrial complex that's grown very, very powerful, and it's demanding more and more and more of these tests. And the problem is that these tests are not calibrated to determine whether you have a current active infection. They are miscalibrated in such a way that if there is any viral fragment, it could be a dead debris, it could be dead debris from months and months ago, anywhere in your sample, it will show up as positive. And so even the New York Times admitted this in late August with an article that should have been game-changing but was immediately ignored by the paper itself and all the rest of the media. The New York Times admitted in late August that 85 to 90% of the so-called positives are not presently infectious. So think about that number when you see, you know, when they say 40,000 positive tests yesterday or something like that, maybe 4,000 of them were actually currently infectious. The rest just had some remnants, some viral debris from
maybe
ago,
something that's not even from something that's not even necessarily COVID. Is that what you're saying?
It probably is an actual COVID. It probably is the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It's not necessarily. There are also just outright false positives from other viruses. There can be cross-reactions from common cold coronaviruses in particular, as I mentioned. But, you know, regardless. And by the way, you could have a fragment of the SARS-CoV-2 virus somewhere in or on you that, you know, but you never had COVID because, you know, we have hundreds, thousands of viruses in our body at any given time, and you know, the fact that you breathed in a little bit of it at some point doesn't mean you ever had enough to actually have an infection. It just means it's somewhere in your body that it exists. And so the extreme oversensitivity of the test results in some cases, false positives, but in other cases, sort of, you know, the experts don't like when you call them false positives, but non-infectious, trivial positives. The test finds virus, but it's not enough to ever make you or anyone else sick. And so, you know, we've got this problem with the calibration of the tests. And the way these tests work is they take the sample and then they use this process called PCR to double the amount of virus in the sample. And then they double it again and again and again. And the number of doubling cycles gives you a sense of how much virus you started with. And so typically when these tests have been done historically, they'll report back to the doctor the number of doubling cycles they needed in order to detect the virus. And we've got a lot of studies now that show that if you have to double it more than 25 or 30 times, you didn't have any live virus to start with. You didn't have a real infection. But the labs in the U.S. are doing 37 to 40 doublings. Some are even doing 45 doublings. And so we're getting this vast number of sort of trivial non-infectious positives. And the New York Times was able to get data from three states, Nevada, Massachusetts, and New York, and they found that 90% of the positives, so-called positives, needed more than 30 doubling cycles, which is the level at which there's probably no infectious virus. And so these tests are poorly calibrated. They're telling a lot of people you're positive, you need to isolate, and all your contacts need to be traced and so forth, even though there's no active infection of any kind. So they're causing huge disruption. And they're not very useful for finding truly infectious people and preventing the spread of the virus because of the long time lag. Because, you know, if you're feeling a little bit off, you're not going to go get tested that day. You're going to wait a couple days. It hasn't gone away. Now you go get tested. They send it off to a lab. It takes a few more days to get back to you. Well, most people are only infectious for 7 days from symptom onset, according to the CDC. So by the time you get your test result back, even if you were infectious, you might not be anymore. And so you can't really change much of your behavior as a consequence. And so we've run over 100 million of these tests. We only do 1.5 million flu tests in an entire year. We've done 100 million plus of these tests. We're doing a million in a single day sometimes now. We're doing, every two days, more tests for this than we do for flu in an entire year. And we're causing more havoc from the false and non-infectious positives than we are any good from finding people who are truly infectious. And what we really need, Sandy, is instant home tests. We need to be able to go to the drugstore, buy a bunch of tests, have them at home. Anytime you're worried or you want to know, or you're going to visit, you know, an elderly parent or grandparent, you just want to be careful, you take the test yourself. You find out the answer you really want to know, not is there any virus anywhere in or on my body. You want to know, am I infectious? And we have tests that are very well calibrated to answer that question, and there have been applications pending at the FDA as far back as March on them, and they haven't approved them. They finally approved one, an Abbott test, with an emergency use authorization a couple of weeks ago, but not for home use. So you only get it with a certified lab tech. Well, that makes it much, much less useful, and, you know, their whole obsession is that all of the data feed into their databases and the government and the headlines and all of this stuff, okay, which is why I think they don't want people to just have home tests and control the information themselves. But, you know, that's the test we really need, is an inexpensive home test. And by the way, unlike the lab tests, which cost $100 to process, the home test could be produced for as little as $1 per test, because it's a specially coated piece of paper. It could be produced very, very cheaply. And, you know, if they were selling them, the Abbott test is $5 because it's like a fancy credit card thing. It's not just a strip of paper. But even at $5, you know, you could go buy 10 of them and have them in your house to use when you want. And so I think it's so important that we get through to the FDA on this idea of authorizing the instant test for home use and letting people control the results themselves, not having them automatically sent to the government, which prevents a lot of people from getting tested because they don't want the information sent to the government.
Phil, you also point out that these tests are more accurate, that they are less sensitive, and they only test you positive if you really, really are positive for COVID, correct?
Right. That's the amazing thing. So the reason the FDA has refused for months to approve these tests, they said, well, we don't want to approve them because they're not as sensitive as the lab tests. Except the whole problem with the lab tests is that they're too sensitive. We want a test that's not as sensitive as the lab test because we don't want to answer the question, is there any virus anywhere in your body? We want to answer the question, are you currently infectious? And that's what these tests are calibrated to do. And so they are less sensitive. That is a good thing. They answer the question we actually want to have answered, which is, you know, am I currently infectious?
You know, of course, the thing that goes through my mind, of course, is that all these are more agencies that I think are not trustworthy. I remember Deborah Birx saying about the CDC, I don't trust, she said publicly in one of those daily briefings, I don't trust anything coming out of the CDC. Now, this is not CDC, this is FDA, but I think the same thing applies, Phil. We've got some shenanigans going on. I don't know what else you would call it, whether it's the profit that's being made by these test producers that are, you know, and they're having a field day producing these nasal poking tests, when you could produce these other tests, and they would be much more clear. I guess the obvious question to me, Phil, is: have you been able to get this information to President Trump?
Yeah, we've lobbied the White House on this, and you know, we have, as I said, there has been some progress because the Abbott test was given an emergency use authorization, so not for home use. So they're sort of halfway there. They've granted at least one manufacturer's instant test an emergency use authorization. And one thing the Trump administration did that I don't love is they bought the entire production run. And so the only way to get that test is, you know, the federal government bought it. They're going to grant it through the state government, which is going to send them to locations and so forth. So they're not really going to be ever on the market. But they did grant the first emergency use authorization to one of these instant tests. We're pushing them on the home testing issue because, you know, the whole new White House strategy, which I love and agree with, as I mentioned in the last segment, the whole idea of don't let it dominate your life, take reasonable precautions and protect the vulnerable. Well, you know, the protect the vulnerable piece of that is enhanced so much if you have home testing, because, look, we know who the vulnerable people are. They're generally people in long-term care facilities or who similarly are of very advanced age and have other serious illnesses and are medically frail. Medical frailty is the best predictor of whether somebody is at risk for this. And, you know, if you have a medically frail parent or grandparent or friend or someone like that, you want to be able to go buy a test and test yourself and your family before you visit them, so you don't have any reason to fear and you don't have to stay away from them and impose social isolation on them as the only way to protect the vulnerable. And so it really goes hand in hand with everything the White House is saying, I think, to make these tests as available as possible and to shift away from doing, you know, a million of these lab tests a day that are causing so much havoc with positive results not reflect infection.
As we talk about this, I can't help, I have voices in my head, and those voices were media people and people on the left and Democrats saying, we need more testing, we need more testing, testing, we have to do more testing. And they were hounding President Trump and his administration because there weren't more tests. And so he delivered that, and now we have all the corruption, I think, of the agencies trying to stop effective testing. That's my spin on it, because I believe it's true. But I want to, in the minutes that we have left here, Phil, there are so many shenanigans. You know, it's perfect, isn't it, that the left is now blaming the Rose Garden introduction of Amy Coney Barrett for, you know, this super spreading event. And I find it very interesting that only Republicans now have COVID. Democrats don't have COVID anymore. It's just Republicans. You know what I mean. And just talk about the inconsistencies, if you would, or what your thoughts are about them blaming this spread on the Rose Garden event.
Well, first of all, there's not been a documented super spread event outdoors anywhere in the world in the history of this epidemic. And so I think to the extent that there may have been a spreading event at that time at the White House, it would have been the indoor reception, not the outdoor Rose Garden ceremony. I would just be shocked if the first documented outdoor super spread event in the entire world occurred at the White House.
Doesn't that make sense to you? It would be an Amy Coney Barrett event where they would be a super spreading event. But I know
I guess according to the media logic, yes, because they're being so wicked in pushing a conservative that behavior would be responsible. I mean, look, Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to do routine testing on Capitol Hill.
I know.
Because she understands that if you do routine testing, you're going to get a bunch of positives.
Yes, and one more point. Tom Tillis was present at the Rose Garden super spreading event, and he wore a mask faithfully, as he does, and he still caught it.
I was told it was better than a vaccine.
Yeah, me too. So it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Phil. And let me just say that his article on this testing, the wrong testing, is on American Commitment. It's too many of the wrong tests and none of the right. We'll put it on our Facebook page because it will be very useful for you when you're talking to your friends and neighbors. It's a game changer. Phil Kirpin, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining me.
All right. Have a good one.
Thank you. It's Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.